This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 12th of October 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 275 of the Monocle Weekly, here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield.
Coming up on the show, we meet an author whose new book explores why locations and landscapes can leave such a lasting impression they develop almost mythological status over time.
Then parasites, pandemics, money and mattresses. We hear from Christopher Cerf, who's written a guide to everything you should be scared of.
And finally, we finish with a dose of creativity from Southern Europe when we meet the man who founded London's Spain Now, a festival lasting over a month all about Spanish culture.
All that, plus some new music as well, here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield. You, me, plane afterwards.
Yes, off to Tokyo.
Yes, and we're returning. We're not just bragging about our holidays here. We're returning to Japan because this week we open a brand new sparkly bureau in Tokyo. We've always had an office there, but it's been in a very nice setting in the Omotesando Hills, but kind of not on ground level, so no one could see it. But now we're having shop, radio, studio, apparently a very big fashion cupboard as well for doing fashion shoots there, office all in kind of one space.
It's going to look rather special. Certainly, according to the plans I've looked at, I haven't actually seen the space itself, but it's in Tomigaya. It's supposed to be a lovely space. And yeah, another bureau opening after, what was it, 2 weeks ago we were in Istanbul for the bureau opening there?
Exactly. And a bit like Left Luggage, you're remaining there for a little while, aren't you?
I am, yes.
You're going to be working out of the Tokyo office.
I will. I'm going to keep my tags on. And I'm going to work, yes, from the Tokyo office for a week, which would be sort of exciting, but also sort of really interesting to sort of, well, to go back to Tokyo and spend a bit of time there. Hopefully not too frustrating to be sort of at my desk, you know, editing copy when I could be outside exploring this wonderful city. But I'm sure there'll be times for bits and pieces of that as well.
And the other reason we're there is we're signing copies of the new Monocle book, The Monocle Guide to Good Business. And we'll also be in, we're going to be in Taiwan this week. We're going to be in Hong Kong next weekend. And then the trip goes on. I'm coming home then, but they're going on to Bangkok, they're going to Australia. So if you want to find out more about that, I think all the dates are actually, well, I hope they're on the...
They're on the website
They're
somewhere.
On the website yeah. somewhere.
You if have you to click admit, on the book.
You click on the book.
You'll find it.
Plus, if you're a subscriber and you haven't got an invitation, you want one, I'm sure if you contact our nice events team, they'll make sure that you get one in the post or by email anyway.
You can't just rock up, though.
No, you need to have your name on the list, but you do need to speak to Emily Smith first. She's persuadable with large amounts of alcohol and some nice flowers. I'm sure you'll get on that list.
We don't have scary bouncers on the door, but we do have very effective, very efficient events organisers like Emily and Kim. And Kim,
yes.
Who would be very sweet, but with, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Kim with a clipboard. Kim. She'll let you in if the name's on there.
Yeah. But yes, that's going to be very exciting. And there's a big group of people going over, aren't there?
Yes, there's you, me, Tyler's going to be there, all sorts of people. Poppy, all Team Japan from the office here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, good. Well, we look forward to that and we look forward to meeting you over the coming couple of weeks if you're in one of those destinations. But next is Mr. Tom Edwards with the News Look Ahead.
And when he's not on holiday in the Bahamas, skiing down the slopes of the French Alps, or drinking martinis in Hawaii, he's here. It's Tom Edwards with the News Look Ahead.
And he is back from holiday, isn't he?
Yes. So it takes you away to the Pacific Islands. That.
Tie your horse up.
like a luau or something, you know, a grass skirt maybe.
Oh no, not a grass skirt.
That sounded more like chaps and a grass skirt, actually, that arrival.
That's a combination. It's a combination I'm confident I can carry off.
Did you carry it off while you're on the beach?
No, I was slightly more conventional than that, just marginally.
Yes, you've had a little holiday this week. You went to Greece.
Yeah, I was in Crete last week. Beautiful.
Okay, that's all over now.
It is over.
Because strangely, there was a day this week when you realised it really was all over. The last gasp of summer was kind of blusterily blown away, wasn't it? Suddenly it was raining, and it was that weird thing when you realise it's very dark when you're going home.
Yeah. Well, it's dark when I was on my way to work, and dark when I went home as well.
That's going to be like this.
And I had to wear a scarf.
April.
I was going to say until 2025.
Scarf, skirt, and chaps. Now that is a look. Only still, you could carry that
still
off
confident,
in Marylebone.
Still confident.
All right. Well, let's start with the week ahead, Tom. Where do you want to begin?
Yeah. Well, there's a few sort of cultural happenings which I thought I'd mention. A couple actually fairly close to home. Frieze London. I think possibly my favourite art fair. And it's obviously just round the corner from our Midori House HQ in Regent's Park. And Rob Bound, who should... Yeah, I feel like he really should be here to tell us about it. But he's a busy man. But he's going to be very busy next week because he'll be presenting some special editions of our Midori House programme live from both Frieze and from Frieze Masters. Always great show. It's a bit of a cultural highlight of the year, actually, for me, I would say.
It is for me. And annoyingly, I'm away the whole week, so I'm going to miss all of it.
I really enjoyed it. In fact, last Frieze, I think I was supposed to be going away. I was supposed to be going to the Netherlands for an interview. And I got to the airport in the morning and there was fog. And so my flight was cancelled. So I couldn't go there. So I thought, I'll just come along to Frieze. And I hung out. I was essentially the runner on the Frieze show,
there's
which
lots
is great.
Of, lots of hanging there. You can hang out. There's pictures hanging. Yeah, it's all about.
It's always such an amazing crowd and really incredible buzz. The first year I went there with Rob Bound, they also have a very good kind of champagne bar. Mid-afternoon, we found that. By the end of the evening, I'd bought something. Couldn't afford it. It was a cheap thing. And Rob was like really encouraging me. No, it's a really good idea.
This Rembrandt, he's up and coming.
Do you still have the work of art?
Yeah, I still do. It's a photograph. It's a Polaroid photograph as well. It's about the smallest thing you could ever purchase at Frieze. But I did kind of like merrily get my credit card out, only because Rob Bound was like kind of like prodding me in the back. Go on. Anyway.
So that's coming up. And also on, so that's kind of happening for most of the week. On Tuesday, we get the Booker Prize winner as well. So another one maybe that Rob would have been interested to hear about. A bit of literature as well. But it's interesting with things like the Booker Prize, these big literary awards. Often people are rather cynical about them. This one we've had... since I think the end of last year, it's changed to get different people from overseas also to enter. So there's a bit, you know, it's a bit more of a kind of a...
Might be an American notable, for the first time.
Exactly, maybe. Who knows?
Doesn't it have a sponsor's name at the beginning of the Booker Prize these days?
Man.
Is it Man Booker Prize?
Man Booker Prize.
Who is Man? Well, Booker as well is a...
Who is Man? Well, see, that's not very good sponsorship, is it? I don't know who Man is.
There's some kind of big PLC who do important things.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
That's one of those horrifying things that we really should know. But anyway, there's three of us who don't.
Exactly. Let me take you to a bit more sort of local esoterica on both sides of the Atlantic. So next Saturday is the Brogdale Apple Festival. Now, obviously, sometimes I pick out these slightly ridiculous local sort of events, but this is quite good because Brogdale is the home of the National Fruit Collection. And it's in Kent, the garden of England.
How do we have a National Fruit Collection? Surely the fruit, after a period of time, starts to
go off a bit. Yeah. Well, no, but what's important about this is you've got over 2,000 varieties of apple. 2,000? Isn't that extraordinary? I'd barely get to double figures.
Apple, orange, banana...
2,000 varieties.
No, apples, I think.
I think just of apples.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 2,000.
Global.
Oh, right. That's what I'm saying. Okay.
The banana is Steve, not a variety Steve is of confident. Apple.
I'm confident I can name 10 fruits.
I like a Braeburn.
Braeburn, quality.
Yeah. Cox's.
Quality apple, Cox's, a classic.
Royal Gala.
Russet's.
Russet.
I'm not sure about it. I think Royal Gala's a bit one of those modern ones.
They're not as good as Braeburn's, but they're all right.
I like a Russet.
Yeah, I like a Russet.
With a piece of cheddar cheese. That's proper English.
Yeah.
Obviously, a lot of these local apples... are being lost because, you know, there's pressure from these big overseas, ritzy, you know, corporate apples coming in.
Granny Smiths
and all that. So this is a good moment to sort of support your local...
I hate Granny Smiths.
Support your local orchard.
That's it. You and me were on the briefing this week. We had a fruit story. That's the second apple story you and me have had this week.
But that was a bad harvest. This is a good news story.
That was bad in Boston, wasn't it?
So we had bad apples and now good apples.
Okay, All in one barrel.
And what's on the other side?
The Trailing of the Sheep Festival.
Now, the trailing of the sheep.
Just listen to this. If you're in Idaho, actually, well, I mean, it's been ongoing, so probably some people know about this already, but it's rising to a crescendo today. Yeah, Trailing of the Sheep. Ketchum and Haley in Sun Valley, Idaho. It celebrates sheep ranching, the old American West. We started on, you know, sort of cowboys and chaps. We're kind of ending up back there. All things lamb and sheep. A parade of several thousand sheep, brackets, living. Wool, which you can use to make, you know, woolen items. And then, of course, because it's, you know, in America and it's the Old West, there's a barbecue. And they kill a lot of the sheep as well. Lots of lamb, special lamb cooking classes. And they've got bagpipes. I don't know why they're...
Why have they got bagpipes?
I don't know. It's part of the frontiersman mentality, perhaps.
It's very funny because none of those great Western movies feature, like, sheep.
They're not prominent.
No,
no, they're it's always the cattle, isn't it?
It's mainly cattle-based.
It's like, round up your sheep.
Yeah, it's not quite, really quite as, yeah, sort of rustling, sheep rustling. It wasn't.
Perhaps you could have like a gayer version as well, llamas instead. That would quite nice, wouldn't it?
Alpacas,
yeah.
massive spit roast like that. So yeah, that's the Trailing the Sheep Festival. I think very much want to mark your card. For
oh, we love that.
There we are.
Well, Tom, thank you very much. You've put the cheer into cheer. Well, I don't know. You put
the cheer into cheer.
Where could you put the cheer into?
Cheerleading.
Yes, you put the cheer into cheerleading, and very well done for that. That was Tom Edwards with the News Look Ahead, and he's much loved as always.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
To Buenos Aires.
To Toronto.
To Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Now, moving can be one of life's most stressful moments, but it can also be rewarding. The latter was the case for our next guest, who moved to a remote farmhouse in the English countryside, Cornwall to be precise. The intensity of how he felt about the location led him to wonder why we react so strongly to certain places and why it is that layers of mythology tend to build up around particular landscape features.
The result of that journey is a new book, Rising Ground, A Search for the Spirit of Place. And its author, Philip Marsden, joins us now. Philip, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks.
Now, this book is all about Cornwall, which for any English or British listener, it conjures up a certain image. We all know Cornwall because, frankly, it's where we all used to go on holiday, isn't it?
Yeah, sitting in the back of cars and feeling a little bit queasy and wishing the journey was over. That was Cornwall for me as a child. And it always had, what I remember about it now is that each time I went there, each sort of period of life, it seemed to sort of bring something out, you know, when you were very little on the sort of beach, bucket and spades, and then boats and fishing and all that sort of stuff. And it just sort of evolved with me. And I've always had a sort of sense of adventure, and Cornwall's always somehow kind of brought it out in me.
Perhaps you could tell us the trigger for the book, because you do cross out the borders of Cornwall in this book. You head to the likes of Glastonbury, for example. The book, at the very beginning, you explain how you found this farmhouse in Cornwall, which is a bit of a trigger for the whole book. And while you were literally clearing it out, all these ideas of place came in to kind of flood your mind.
That's right. I mean, yes, as you say, the trigger was moving house. Well, not so much the moving as that kind of manoeuvring to sell one house and get this other. We saw a small ad in the local paper for this wonderful sort of looking farmhouse on the edge of a tidal creek. We went there, and before I knew, got out of the car, I knew this is where I wanted to live. But, you know, it then took actually 2 years before we managed to kind of get it all in place. And during that time, I sort of realised that falling in love with a place meant exactly that, with all the kind of sweaty palms and anxious moments and the kind of flip side of all sorts of passions. But it was exactly that that brought to a head the idea of place for me, which was one of those ideas which I realised, having seen it, that it had been sort of swirling around for years and had informed a lot of my previous travels. So in a sense, this book is a sort of bringing together of all the sort of unstated motivations in previous travels and a way to hang it on Cornwall. But as you say, it does also sort of flick off around England and Britain and around the globe, actually.
You mentioned other writing you've done. You've written lots of travel books elsewhere in the world, and yet this is essentially a travel book where you don't really have to go that far. What is it that you found about Cornwall that allowed you to sort of explore those issues of place that perhaps you hadn't been able to explore when you were going far further afield?
Well, two things. Firstly, my own personal familiarity with it. As we said, as a child, I've known it sort of all my life and sort of gradually came to settle there. But the other thing is that intrinsically Cornwall has this extraordinary freight of mythology around it. and a sort of stunning range of landscapes, if you like, not only the coastal scenery, but also the moorland. Then you've got old mining country. The whole place is full of old stories and old mythologies and folk tales. And so the idea of place being layered with these stories and meanings comes out absolutely in Cornwall, and there's a sort of stunning range of it. So in a sense, it was a sort of crucible in which to sort of mix all these ideas up, ideas of place and mythology and how the past is sort of contained in landscape and contained in the land. So familiarity with it enabled me to sort of bring the personal into it, but really it's just one of those places in the world which attracts stories and ideas to it. And that was the idea. I mean, the book is a sort of book of ideas in a sense, and about the central idea being place, but also about how we interpret landscape and how we look at the land, and how in different periods we've looked at the land in different ways, going right back to the Neolithic. So Cornwall has it all, plenty of Neolithic monuments.
And Cornwall, for listeners around the world, is a kind of a special kind of county, certainly within Britain. It's always seemed as physically it's quite isolated from the rest of the country. It's surrounded by sea on most sides, apart from Devon, rammed up against it on the other. It feels a bit cut off. It feels a bit mysterious. Is it this sense of, you know, mystery that makes place powerful over it? Is it when we don't quite know its past, or when we have ideas of, you know, generations way back using it for faith or for all sorts of things, mm-hmm. that it really anchors in us? Because I always think of, you know, the likes of, you know, Stonehenge, but you talk about Bodmin Moor. Mm-hmm. These are the places which seem to kind of have some strange effect on us.
Yes, I mean physically it is distinct. Also culturally, linguistically, there's a sort of remnants of Cornish language. And one of the things I explore is the way that the Cornish language, which is dead now, although it's being revived in some sense, but it's not a vernacular language, but it does survive in place names. And one can have a lot of fun both understanding particular places, but also understanding the language by breaking them up. But it is, you know, it's a place that has sort of stories all around it. And in a sense, what I was trying to do was not so much explore Cornwall, but actually particular places within it. And in a way, this traditional idea of being familiar with a much smaller area of the earth, if you like, than we are now, is the central idea. And that span of territory is very much sort of what you can see or what you can walk to in half a day. And so I was exploring those sort of pockets, that scale of territory. And even Cornwall itself, which is quite small and isolated and distinct, is an abstract notion in those terms. And I mean, I think place, in one sense, the way I've used it, is that particular traditional sense of a bit of land that one can know in a very particular way. And I think it's something that we've lost. You know, we're much more mobile now, we're much more aware in an abstract sense of other places. So it was a sort of re-examination, if you like, of the way that perhaps we used to engage with the land around us and its shape, and the way that the shape became a sort of almost a cosmological manifestation. And it is, I mean, that's, you know, one could find examples where in different cultures, the shape of the land does have these sort of cultural weights. So it is about Cornwall, but actually it's about places within Cornwall. And in that sense, I think it's more universal, because everywhere and in all times, you know, that's how we relate to the world.
It's striking when reading the book how, you know, despite the fact that, yeah, as we said earlier, we've all been to Cornwall on holidays, you know, whether as children or later on in life, we've all had, you know, cream teas or Cornish ice cream and so on. And yet I feel like I'm reading about a completely different place that I've never been to before. This is a very different Cornwall from, you know, the Cornwall of Padstow and your summer holiday.
Absolutely. I mean, in part, it's inland. It's loosely a sort of walk down the spine of Cornwall. I mean, it's sort of quite a meandering route, but it's very much exactly, as you say, away from those sort of holiday resorts of the coast. And it throws up a different world. I mean, one of the interesting things about Cornwall is, as opposed to the rest of England, is that it doesn't go through the pattern of villagization. When the sort of Saxons and Normans came, there were clusters of villages, whereas in Cornwall, where there was never the same presence, there remains this pattern of remote farmsteads and trevs, as they're called, or tre in Cornish. And so when you walk the sort of old paths, you sense the sort of connection of linking up old farmsteads, and not paths between villages, but paths between farmsteads. And that still exists. And I know Cornwall pretty well, but I had the experience countless times of being a few miles from somewhere I knew, but actually being in a different world, and coming to farms which I wasn't quite sure when I approached whether they were inhabited or not.
And not often sure they, what sort of reception you're going to get if they were.
Exactly. I mean, it's extraordinary now in the 21st century to sort of have that. But there are little pockets of Cornwall that display it.
Now, when we travel around the world, you know, we pop into Cambodia or to India, and we often go to places, landscapes that we think kind of tell us something about India, something about the East. And maybe when you're living in your own country, you fail to do that. I wondered when you'd done this walk whether you felt some greater sense of not what it means to be British or English or Cornish, but a greater sense of what Britain is. Because as you say, we rush around in cars and so fleetingly are our glimpses of the countryside that you don't often stop and feel and realise what the landscape is doing to you. Did it give you a greater sense of what these islands are about?
Well, frankly, no, actually, because in a sense, as I say, it was away from that. I mean, you do get the sense that any sort of nationhood or even sort of a local, there's quite a strong sense of Cornish identity now, but actually how sort of artificial, in a sense, that is, and that it doesn't relate to one's own day-to-day life with the land. And I one of the themes that I was exploring was what archaeologists call ritual landscape or sacred landscape, and which is an idea I loved. I mean, it chimes with the idea of falling in love with a place and elevating particular places to something you really love. But in the Neolithic, the most recent interpretations of things like standing stones, stone circles, stone rows, in relation to sort of their visual references. So very often these monuments are now understood to refer to, say, peaks that one could see, or tors, these strange natural forms on hilltops you get in the moors of Cornwall and Devon. And so the thought is this, that all around these sort of sacred places, there are networks of monuments which refer to the physical land. And so they build up the sense of a whole area of sanctity. And this is something that's universal. I mean, one can look for examples in northwestern Europe with Neolithic sacred landscapes, but you can also find examples. I mean, in India, there's where Hinduism has not moved. It refers again to particular places, and I mean, there's one quote that says all India, in a sense, is a sacred landscape. So, I was wanting to sort of re-engage with the sanctity of place, and not just the love of place, but the sort of sanctity and the way that we seem to be sort of re-engaging with the natural world and with landscape in a way that hasn't happened in generations, really. And I found it very sort of moving, in a sense, that this can be seen in the latest interpretation of Neolithic monuments, that the same love of place gave root to the sort of sacred landscapes and the monuments. So the idea that it's all about place and all about how we feel when we're in a particular place, that feeling which anyone who loves walking has had, and you come over the brow of a hill and suddenly you're on a particular array of hills and valleys and things, and that seems to be, if we could believe the latest interpretations, the way that Neolithic people in the first sort of expression of collective culture, the way they sought to express their religious life.
But do you think that can only be done in a place like Cornwall that is essentially still countryside? Or can you actually do that in even a city like London?
Well, in an archaeological sense, the west of Britain, the northwest of Europe, I mean, Brittany, Iberia, has this collection of monuments, and something about the rock itself lends itself to sort of megalith. What I wanted to do in the book was to show how the love of place and the response to place is something which is both universal and timeless. So we can all sort of build our own sense of sacred landscape, if you like, which might have an urban context. You know, if you love a particular city, or it can be networked with the same idea of particular response, and you can build your own mythology to it. And also, you know, all cities have deep and very manifest past, so that one can explore. What I wanted to do in this book was to show the pleasure, which was a sort of revelation to me, of really going into something that seems familiar and sort of exploring the past, going into archives, talking to people, and actually unlayering these places with the sort of layers of the past. And you can do that in a city, you can do it anywhere, and anywhere that's familiar, in a way that the more familiar it is, the more rewarding it is.
Well, Philip, thank you very much for coming in to see us. Philip Marsden, that is, with his new book, Rising Ground, A Search for the Spirit of Place.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck. A little bit later on in the show, we're going to be talking about a month-long Spanish festival. To get us in the mood, this is Sophie de la Torre with Vermilion.
The rush of what's new hits hard as at midnight. I take a few shots till it starts to feel right. But I think of you when I'm passing the streetlight. I think of you when I'm passing the streetlight. Oh, I don't wanna feel empty anymore. I don't wanna feel lonely anymore. Oh, I love these streets. I love these streets, but they were meant for me to walk. I love these people. I love the people, but they never seem to wanna talk. And it's been my only home ever since I saw the sky of Vermilion. The sky of Vermilion.
That was Vermilion by Sophie de la Torre. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Now, are you the sort of person that uses hand wipes? Are you the sort of person that flosses every night? Do you opt for the hot air hand-drying machines over germ-infested towels in public toilets? Do words like pathogens, pandemics, parabens, parasites scare you? What about mattresses or money?
Well, if it offers any comfort, you're not alone. A bit earlier, Robert Bound spoke to Christopher Cirth, co-author of the book Encyclopedia Paranoica, the indispensable guide to everyone and everything you should be afraid of. Chris joined us from the New York Bureau.
Now, first things first, this is a great name for a book, the Encyclopedia Paranoica. What should be the thing I'm most scared of?
Well, it's hard to pick one thing because if you look at the book, Rob, you'll see that just about everything.
It's in alphabetical order, exactly.
And everything is self-contradictory, so there's no way out, basically. If you're told not to eat carrots and eat spinach instead, that's fine. But when you look up spinach, you'll find that that's bad for you, too.
Did the idea for the book kind of come out of that? The fact that in every newspaper and every TV show, on every blog, everywhere we look, we are offered advice pro, advice con, and it's very difficult to kind of know what sense to make of the world. Is this a sort of philosophical treatise on carry on as you were, chaps, you're going to be just fine?
Well, you could say that, though I think that's probably what we had in mind, but we convinced ourselves, Henry Beard, my co-author and I, as we worked on the book, that there really is no hope. We hope our book saves your life, and we apologize if it doesn't, which it probably won't.
And you list all sorts of things in it, clearly. It is an encyclopedia. I wonder where the fear factor comes from, rather than the specific things, maybe the root of the fear. Where does it come from? Does it come from the media? Does it come from a lack of faith that people maybe are suffering from, or the enlightenment perhaps that people have nowadays? What do you think is the root of the paranoia that gives the book its title?
Well, it's hard to really pick one thing, but I think you were right, Rob, when you mentioned the media. As you said at the beginning of the interview, every single newspaper you pick up or blog you go to has a new warning in it telling you that something you thought was great for you, like Sprouts or whatever, is actually terrible for you. And after a while, it gets hopelessly confusing and you begin to realize there's absolutely nothing that's safe.
There are sort of various examples. We're talking about Sprouts, but we could equally, and not glibly here, but we could equally be talking about global terrorism, the idea that we should all be scared all the time of everything, right? Now, there have been famous instances in the media, and we'll keep on that for another minute or two, perhaps, of having like a sort of, I know, in Fox News, I think, had a sidebar on their screen telling you exactly how scared to feel at exactly what point due to the supposed terror threat. This was maybe 10 years ago or so. But it's stuff like this that presumably adds into mainstream fear, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. In fact, it was the U.S. government. I love to blame almost anything on Fox News, but this one is on the U.S. government. Okay. They had threat alert warnings of orange and red and so on.
Yeah.
And it very seldom got below the second highest level. So the obvious point was we must be terrified at all times.
And what about, I wonder whether guilt kind of plays into this, that we've kind of built this sort of almost brick walls around ourselves, and we've got this kind of, you know, what we think are hermetically sealed environments that we live in, whether they're in our super safe motor cars or our apartments back home. Do we feel maybe guilty that we've kind of built, at least in the Western world, these edifices of civilization around us, and that we're almost welcoming some problems in?
Well, there are a lot of answers to that. I think we do feel
I thought I'd ask
guilty.
You a 73-point question there, just to keep you
indeed.
On your toes, Chris.
Well, I have 73 answers. I hope we have time. And assuming the world doesn't end before I give you all 73 of them. But I think we do feel guilty. And we're made to feel guilty if we do anything that isn't healthy, like if we smoke or drink. We worry terribly that we're going to die ourselves, or worse still, leave our loved ones behind. So that's a part of it. And I think, you know, that also actually one of the ironies of all this is by being hermetically sealed, as you put it, we're actually making things worse. Because superbugs, for example, are happening because we are killing so many bacteria that only the ones that are able to resist all those antibacterial things are surviving. And as a result, they're mutating into bacteria that we can't kill. So that's, of course, something we stress in the book as something to worry about very, very deeply.
Yeah, it's interesting you should mention that, because you do mention in the book this idea of our obsession with antibacterial sprays that we spray over maybe the bathroom floor, maybe the kitchen workspace. I wonder whether these were a sign of a kind of short-termism in the way that we think as human beings. We think we kind of don't want to really clean out the cupboards, but as long as we spray a bit of Brand X antibacterial spray on the work surface, we're going to be okay. Is there a message, if not a message, did you notice a bit of short-termism in the thinking that underlies your book?
You're absolutely right. I think everybody just hopes that if they stop eating one thing or that if they don't go out today or whatever, they're going to be just fine. And of course, fate doesn't work that way, which, as you mentioned at the outset, is really the point of the whole book.
Having asked you that question, I'm now going to ask you to take a little bit of a longer view on history. And I wonder whether there's a simple answer to this, whether you feel that we are cleaner or not. Or it may take yourself in New York City right now. Do you think that New York City is a cleaner or dirtier place maybe than it was 50, 100, 100 years ago?
Good gosh, I might have to give you a serious answer to that. It's very definitely...
Don't worry, we'll come back to the glibness in about 30 seconds, Chris.
Oh, thank goodness. But actually, it is cleaner. It is cleaner, and though life expectancies are beginning to get shorter, which we have to worry about tremendously, over the last several decades, of course, they've gotten much, much longer, and people are much healthier. But of course, we have Ebola to worry about now, which is scaring everybody for real.
Does the book have a moral to it? Your introduction is sort of interesting, but is it saying, you know, we've all got our 3 score years and 10, we might as well just get on with it. We might as well make hay while the sun shines. If we get knocked down by a superbug, it might be a London bus swinging around a corner too fast, or it might be a superbug. We've just got to get on with it. Is that kind of the moral of the story? I don't want to do a plot spoiler, but it is, of course, a work of reference.
Well, yes. And after you look up all the hundreds of entries, I think you'll come to the conclusion, we hope you will, that you just mentioned, Rob, that there's really no way to protect yourself against all these things. For example, talking about the long term, we discovered a comet called Comet Catalina that's supposed to hit the Earth maybe about 2085. But there really is no point in worrying about that, since the asteroid Apophis may hit us in 2036. So we don't have to worry about Comet Catalina until 2036 goes by.
And finally, Chris, I'd like to ask you about the Cassandra Institute. This is a body that you've cited in the book. This is fictitious, I presume, is it? This is presumably the daughter of Priam, who was given this great knowledge, this ability to prophesy, and was never believed. This is a nice joke between you and Henry Beard, I presume, isn't it?
Well, you could say it was a joke, but I'm rather insulted. All my many, many colleagues the world over who slave hard every day at the Cassandra Institute would be very insulted.
So there is such a thing as the Cassandra Institute?
Well, it is perhaps not as big as we've let on. And
I love this.
Its offices do happen to be in the same place where my office is, but that doesn't mean it's not a very important organization. Of course, no one pays any attention to it, which is why it's called the Cassandra Institute.
Well, I apologize wholeheartedly to the members and all the people that work hard in the Cassandra Institute, everyone from the top down, and I look forward to reading more of their findings in the future.
That was Christopher Cirth, co-author of the book Encyclopedia Paranoica, speaking to our Robert Bound.
Up next, we take a look into the new cultural offerings Spain has for us.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks. It's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Food on film, we travel to Helsinki to meet the merchants serving up the very best in Nordic cuisine at Helsinki's oldest portside market.
Service and quality are at the very heart of the market's reinvention and its continued importance over the past 120 years. Many of the stallholders have held pitches in these pinewood stalls for generations and forged close relationships with their long-held customers.
Market value, now playing in the film section of monocle.com.
Thank you.
You are back with the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck. Spain Now is a month and a half long celebration of Spanish culture held in London, and it began just a few days ago.
Already in its sixth year, it showcases what new cultural creations Spain has recently come up with, including films, exhibitions, literature, and even talk of architecture. Spain Now has been created by Antonio Molina Vasquez, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the show. Now, first of all, let's just ask a quick question. So is Spanish architecture, design, writers, but interesting, lots of these people happen to be based in London or based in New York or based around the world. Is that a reflection of the fact that, you know, things have been a little bit kind of tough the last few years and people have gone out of Spain? Or has that always been the way that Spanish artists have kind of gone abroad to find their inspiration?
I think there's been, I mean, obviously the situation has got perhaps magnified in the past couple of years, but there always has been a Spanish creative community around the world. In London, for instance, I mean, we have one of the largest creative communities in Europe, Spanish creative communities. I think the last figures, I think we're talking about 20,000 come and go. So although there has been a 100% increase in those numbers, they were always there. And that's what we try always to do. I mean, we do try and source the program mainly from Spain, but always giving a platform to those Spaniards who actually are abroad, creating abroad as well.
This is the sixth year that you've been doing Spain Now. It's almost as if you began it when the economic crisis began. That crisis is still obviously not quite as severe, but still ongoing. Do you think that the creativity of Spain has sort of come out of the last few years? It's sort of reflected in the way that the country's coped with the recession?
I don't think creativity, arts and culture, you know, can actually have their back turned to the reality of a country. But there's also realities manifold. It's not just one reality. There's the plight of the country, the economic plight of the country. But at the same time, creativity and the inclusion of creativity has always been there. So, yes.
And tell me, one of the reasons, I guess, that you're doing this is to introduce more names to the British public and the public around the world. What's interesting, we do some work with, you know, the Spanish Tourism Board, and they're always saying it's British people, they always go to Spain, they go to the beach for 2 days, they don't travel around, then they come home. There was some horrific figures that we were told the other day that something like 70% of Brits, when they go to the Canary Islands, if you ask them which island they were on as they were leaving the airport, they couldn't even name the island they're on. Is there a sense for you that, you know, British people, yeah, they may have got to know Almodovar, but beyond that, they know the classics, but they're not very good at engaging with contemporary Spain. Is that one of your ambitions?
That's precisely why and how Spain Now was born. I mean, I've lived in London for the past 21 years, and my frustration was precisely that. Seeing that Velázquez, Goya, Almodóvar, Picasso were very well represented in massive exhibitions, but really very little was being presented as to what was being created or happening in, you know, Spain at the moment, really. So yes, totally. And I think that's changing a little in the past few years. I mean, we have seen also an increase in the number of British audiences coming to Spain Now. At first, the first 3 years of Spain Now were mainly populated by Spaniards and stray Spaniards that, you know, just came running to Spanish events.
Is that a problem with an event like this, that you don't want it to just appeal to the diaspora? In fact, actually, the diaspora is the last people that you really want to come, because they like Spain anyway. They're not the ones you're trying to get a message across to.
Exactly. I mean, we won't exclude, I mean, exclude them, of course. We won't say we do. But it's also true, and you'll be surprised, how very little those very Spaniards know about creative Spain and contemporary arts and culture in Spain at the moment. So in a way, I mean, it's also useful because we are presenting something that they don't know. But yes, I mean, our main target audience are actually, you know, London-based or British-based audiences.
Antonio, let's look at some of the things that you're bringing to the festival. One of the things is photography. I know there's a big tie-up with a Spanish photography festival.
Correct.
Could you just tell us what's happening in Spanish photography? What kinds of images and photographers are you bringing to the city?
Well, for the first year, and we're very excited about this, we're bringing Foto España. So Foto España is the longest running photography festival, one of the longest running and largest in Europe. It's been running for the past 17 years. And for the first time this year, we are collaborating with them, bringing Ricky Davila. Ricky Davila is at the moment the director of the Center of Photography in Bilbao, but also a very well-respected and renowned photographer in his own right. And we bring him his exhibition, his series called Iberica, which sort of offers a snapshot, and sometimes not very pleasing to the eye, snapshot of the reality city at Spain at the moment. So, yes, we're very excited about it. I mean, that's very documentary. You could call it documentary photography or anthropological photography. But I think it's very quite hard-hitting, beautiful portraits, though.
And just quizzing you a little bit about that, although he's based in Bilbao, is he a Basque photographer originally? Or is he a Basque person? Or is he... Because Ibérica... Even the notion of it being discussed by someone from one of the regions is fascinating, because you know we're seeing what's happening in Catalonia, the kind of expressions of independence by the various regions. So his image of the whole of Ibérica, is it fed in with these ideas of you know what that even means?
Well, I mean, he's been based in Madrid most of the time, although now he is based in Bilbao. And notions of, obviously, the reality, that reality of the Basque country as part of the Iberian Peninsula is very well reflected in the exhibition, absolutely. I mean, I think about 4 or 5 of the portraits presented and 2 of the landscapes actually from the Basque Country. Yes.
One of the other things that you're very keen to promote this year is Spanish architecture. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you'll be doing is hosting the London premiere of El Edificio. My Spanish isn't as good as Andrew's, which obviously means the building. Before you tell us a bit more about that, let's hear a little clip.
Este edificio es enorme, es una mole inmensa, ¿no? Yo llevo aquí ya 2 años y todavía no conozco todo el edificio, o sea, con eso te digo bastante. Tiene algo mágico, tiene algo, su personalidad, su cosa. Es indefinible. Me gusta, y me gusta trabajar aquí.
So tell us first of all about this film, what it's all about.
Well, the film, the documentary directed by Victor Moreno, narrates the process of renovation of Edificio España, which is bang in the middle of the centre of Madrid and is an icon of 1950s prosperity in the country, you know, the boom years, the post-Franco years, I suppose. And it has been, enveloped in a certain controversy because of the renovation or the lack of respect towards the period features of the building, which some of them were well protected. So the documentary narrates that and asks the impressions of the builders and people are working hands-on on that project.
And we should also reveal that after the screening of the film, a certain gentleman called Liam Aldous, who's Monocle's Madrid correspondent and who's covered this story for The Urbanist on Monocle 24, he's coming over here to interview the director straight afterwards.
Wonderful.
So, go Liam.
Thank you, Liam.
And another thing you're introducing London to is Spanish humour, and that's Spanish humour on the printed page. Mm-hmm. You've got 2 books in front of you here. Could you just tell us what they are and what is Spanish humour?
Sure. The 2 books that we're presenting on the 20th of November in collaboration with Hispa Books, the London Review Bookshop, are The History of Silence by Pedro Zarraluki and Anton Malik Wants to Be Happy by Nicolás Casariego, both very well-known writers and novelists in Spain, but whose works haven't been translated into English until now, that is. And yes, the common thread theme of the books is humour, and that will be also the theme of the subject of the event at the London Review Bookshop, and will be moderated by Samantha Schnee, who's the founder editor of World Without Borders. We'll see whether that humour translates really into English. The translators assure me it does.
Just as funny in English as in Spanish.
Absolutely. Although that humour, you know, it sometimes is quite dark as well.
Well, yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about. I mean, if you can distill Spanish humour into sort of a 60-second soundbite, what is it? What is it that makes things funny in Spanish fiction?
Actually, I think Spanish humour is very similar to that of Monty Python in many ways. And I think you'll see, I mean, some people won't agree with me, but I that's why Monty Python is so popular in Spain, because their humour translates very, very well into Spanish. And the other way around, I'm sure it's the same. Yeah.
So a touch of the surreal again.
Yeah, very surreal, very dark, very really... I suppose surreal and nonsensical in a way is a good definition.
Well, I think we had a good run through. Are there any other highlights you think we should make sure we see before we let you get on your way?
Sure. Yes. I mean, we're very excited about the Open Studio Weekend, and the Open Studio Weekend is going back to those Spaniards, actually London-based Spaniards. We have a whole weekend, 7th to the 9th of November, where a 10 different artists will open the doors to their studios and will create specific works so people can actually go and see them. Also, we are at the Handmade Gallery in Fitzrovia. That will be our creative hub this year. And over those 3 days, we'll have all sorts of performances and talks and the launch of a record label as well. So Hispano record label. So it's all about collaboration with Spain now, as you can see. And we'll close on the 24th and 25th of November at Salas Wells with the world premiere of Provisional Landscapes by Avatar Ayuso, a dancer choreographer that's really emerging, but it's got a lot of very interesting things to say. And it's beautiful. Her work is absolutely stunning.
Fantastic. Well, Antonio Molina Vazquez, thank you very much for coming in. Best of luck with everything for Spain now. And I'm sure we'll see you again for year 7 next year.
Thank you very much for having me.
So that is that. We've got the entire next few weeks sorted out with Spain now, haven't we?
Yes, and it's always nice to find out what your team are doing by reading a flyer. Liam Aldous, thanks for letting us know you were coming to London. I did hear a hint actually this week, because we did an event actually with Spain this week as well. And I did hear a rumour there that he was coming over. He hasn't told me yet.
No. There we are. We'll go down and see that. Also, Rising Ground, a great book about Cornwall. So we've covered Spain, we've covered Cornwall, and also lots of things to be scared about.
Yes, and Philip Marsden is seriously bright.
He is. He is very bright indeed.
I had to kind of listen quite carefully to my to his answers. No, it's great that he's, it's one of those books which, actually, when you read it, his use of language is so kind of simple and spare and rich and revealing. Yet, as you read it, you realise that he's imparting all these kind of bigger thoughts along the way.
Exactly. It's not just a book about where to go in Cornwall.
No. There's not a mention of fudge or a Cornish pasty in there.
Or cream tea.
No.
Or Cornish ice cream. Cornwall's got a lot of food, actually, hasn't it? Anyway, that's a whole nother show. Marcus might do that on the menu. There we are. That is that. Monocle Weekly was produced by Marcus Hippie. The studio manager was Claire Urban. The Weekly will be back at the same time next week with...
Well, not me.
Not me.
Who's going to be here? Find out next week.
For now, though, from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Goodbye.